open a book and it invites you to fall in.
That was my North Star. I always sailed towards that star.
If you're in a platoon in combat, the contract between everybody is that I may not like you, but I'll die for you. And if everyone acts that way, everyone in the platoon has a much higher chance of coming home alive.
Welcome to the National Writer Series on Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Journalist Sebastian Younger says that veterans face some of their greatest struggles after their return home.
They felt safer in combat with each other than they felt alone in society not getting shot at. And what they missed when they got home was being part of something, of serving something that was bigger than them that made them feel secure. And they could not get that in the cul-de-sac in their suburb where they lived.
Sebastian Younger is an author and Oscar-nominated documentary filmmaker. His book, The Perfect Storm, was made into a Hollywood movie. Younger's latest book is Tribe, on homecoming and belonging. Sebastian Younger is joined by Philip Caputo, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and novelist whose book, A Rumor of War, is considered a landmark of Vietnam War literature. Caputo and Younger talk with retired U.S. diplomat and former chief political advisor to NATO, Jack Siegel. Siegel asked Caputo to start the discussion by reading from his book.
I'll read just a couple of paragraphs from the book, both to give you an idea of the nature of the war as I experienced it and the emotional effect it had on me, which was, in the end, elegiac. The war started at night. The 8-inch and 155 millimeter guns commenced their regular shellings, and the VC began their sniping and mortaring. Our patrols slipped down darkened trails to set ambushes or to be ambushed themselves. On the perimeters, sentries listened and looked into the blackness, lighted now and then by dull flares. They waited, alternately bored and nervous, for the infiltrators who sometimes probed our lines to lob grenades over the wire or spray a position with carbine fire. They came in twos and threes, and that is how they died and how our own men died, in twos and threes. We fought no great battles. There was no massive hemorrhaging, just a slow, steady trickle of blood drawn in a series of ambushes and firefights. Although there was more action than in the spring, contacts with the enemy were still rare. Almost every hour of every night, the same reports came in over the radios in the operations tent. They came in from outposts and patrols, and we could hear them whenever we stood watch, 20 different voices saying the same thing, like a choir reciting a chant, contact negative, all secure, situation remains the same. When contacts did occur, they were violent, but nothing ever really changed. The regiment sat in the same position it had occupied since April, and the details of the surrounding landscape became so familiar that it seemed as if we had been there all our lives. Men were killed and wounded, and our patrols kept going out to fight in the same places they had fought in the week before and the week before that. The situation remained the same. One of the things that was not the same was when my best friend was killed in action. His name was Walt Levy, Lieutenant Walter Levy. I dedicated the book partly to him. I wrote an elegy to him in this book, and I'd like to read that for you. So much was lost with you, so much talent and intelligence and decency. You were the first from our class of 1964 to die. There were others, but you were the first and more. You embodied the best that was in us. You were a part of us, and a part of us died with you. The small part that was still young, that had not yet grown cynical, grown bitter, grown old with death. Your courage was an example to us, and whatever the rights or wrongs of the war, nothing can diminish the rightness of what you tried to do. Yours was the greater love. You died for the man you tried to save, and you died pro patria. It was not altogether sweet and fitting, your death, but I am sure you died believing it was pro patria. You were faithful, Your country is not. As I write this 11 years after your death, the country for which you died wishes to forget the war in which you died. Its very name is a curse. There are no monuments to its heroes, no statues in small town squares and city parks, no plaques, nor public wreaths, nor memorials. For plaques and wreaths and memorials are reminders, and they would make it harder for your country to sink into the amnesia for which it longs. It wishes to forget, and it has forgotten. But there are a few of us who remember because of the small things that made us love you, your gestures, the words you spoke, and the way you looked. We loved you for what you were and what you stood for. Thank you.
Phil refers to the world outside the wire and the world inside the wire in his book. And inside the wire was a different world. It could also have a funny twist to it. When I was serving in Vietnam and I was at a small base camp, and there was a habit in those days to send audio tapes back home instead of writing letters. So you had these little tiny audio cassettes, and not even cassettes, they were reel to reel. And so I was sending these tapes back to my family, and suddenly I got visited by the Red Cross, and they said, "You have to stop sending those tapes back." Because in the background of my telling everyone how good it was and how everything was safe and calm was a 155 millimeter cannon going off about every 3 minutes. Now, you did manage to detach yourself once you got inside the wire, that's no doubt about it. But the theme that I found right away in these two main books that we're looking at tonight has to do with the word tribe. That we see this compact, this group of people who call themselves a tribe, and they might be members of a platoon, or they might be an actual tribe. And Sebastian has written a lot about this in a way that really fascinating, in a fascinating way, pulls together these two ideas of the tribe in Vietnam or the tribe in Quirinal Valley and the tribes that we have in our society. So I'll ask Sebastian now to read a bit.
Thank you so much. It was a really beautiful and heartbreaking elegy, by the way. Thank you for reading that. This book is about community, about human groups. We're a social species, and we do well when we're in a group with people that we're close to, and we do terribly on our own. We die, basically. I started trying to unravel this idea after I spent a year off and on with a platoon in combat in eastern Afghanistan. I'd covered war for a long time. I'd never been with American soldiers. And to my surprise, after a brutally hard deployment, a few months after they got back to their base in Italy, most of the guys that I was with wanted to go back. They didn't want to come home to America. They wanted to go home to Restrepo. That's how they thought of it. And I was trying to, I thought this needs to be understood because it's not an obvious choice. So this is just the beginning, the first couple of paragraphs of my book, Tribe. Perhaps the single most startling fact about America is that, alone among the modern nations that have become world powers, it did so while butted up against 3,000 miles of howling wilderness populated by Stone Age tribes. From King Philip's War in the 1600s until the last Apache cattle raids across the Rio Grande in 1924, America waged an ongoing campaign against a native population that had barely changed technologically in 15,000 years. Over the course of three centuries, America became a booming industrial society that was cleaved by class divisions and racial injustice, but glued together by a body of law that, theoretically at least, saw all people as equal. The Indians, on the other hand, and by the way, I use that word because I was admonished by an Apache who told me that Native American simply means someone who's born in North America, but he was an Indian. So just to make that clear, I considered him more of an authority than me on that word, so Indian it is. The Indians, on the other hand, lived communally in mobile or semi-permanent encampments that were more or less run by consensus and broadly egalitarian. Individual authority was earned rather than seized and imposed only on people who were willing to accept it. Anyone who didn't like it was free to move somewhere else. The proximity of these two cultures over the course of many generations presented both sides with a stark choice about how to live. By the end of the 19th century, factories were being built in Chicago, and slums were taking root in New York, while Indians fought with spears and tomahawks 1,000 miles away. It may say something about human nature that a surprising number of Americans, mostly men, wound up joining Indian society rather than staying in their own. They emulated Indians, married them, were adopted by them, and on some occasions even fought alongside them. And the opposite almost never happened. Indians almost never ran away to join white society. Emigration always seemed to go from the civilized to the tribal, and it left Western thinkers flummoxed about how to explain such an apparent rejection of their society. Thank you.
Now, Sebastian, just to continue on that theme, the appeal of tribal life can seem somewhat mysterious when we characterize these tribes as primitive and brutal and so unlike what the people who left those societies were brought up to understand was valuable. Today in modern society, people can live alone and feel safe, but they are not part of that tribe. What does the tribal life have that the modern society fails to deliver that would cause these soldiers to say, I want to go back to the tribe in Coronel Valley?
Yeah, I mean, the irony, and it makes perfect evolutionary sense, but the irony of the sort of human spirit is that the worse the circumstances, the better the behavior. The worse things are, the better people act with each other. And that's because humans survive collectively, and individually they die. And so as things get bad, there is a pressure based in our evolution, a pressure to collectivize, to organize in very closely knit groups. When things stabilize, when they're more peaceful, when they're easier, there is also an evolutionary pressure to pursue individual interests. So the individual interest and the sort of commitment to the group, those are two drivers in human behavior, and basically they exist in a kind of dynamic tension. And as crises arise, people group together. They lose their individual autonomy, but they survive. Then things get better, and off they go again. And what's interesting about this is that clearly, in our evolutionary past, conditions were difficult and dangerous, because it seems to be that people, if they are allowed to become too individual, to live lives that are too autonomous from the group, there's a great liberty there, but it's very, very difficult on our mental health. And so the irony for modern society is that as wealth goes up and individuality goes up, the suicide rate goes up. As things get easier for us physically and more convenient, more automated, the suicide rate goes up, the depression rate goes up, the anxiety rate goes up, the PTSD rate goes up. All of those sort of mental health values, all those lines go in the wrong direction. And as soon as there's a crisis, for example, 9/11, I live in New York City, after 9/11, the suicide rate went down in New York. I found a study in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, 1969, 1970. There was a lot of violence and riots and a very, very violent time in Northern Ireland. And an Irish sociologist did a study and found that the more He studied mental health rates district by district, and the more violent the district, the lower the rate of depression. And the only county that saw depression go up was County Derry, that had no violence whatsoever.
Phil, you also talk about this post-traumatic stress, and you describe in one of your books the idea that you came out of the war, and you were you certainly weren't, you didn't seek out a relaxing lifestyle. You ended up at the Democratic National Convention in 1968, this idea that you found some comfort until that moment when suddenly you were taken back into flashbacks of Vietnam. What happened to you in that circumstance?
Now, you're not speaking of the Democratic National Convention.
No. Right? Okay. Well, that was also the...
I was not elected. I think what does happen is that in the experience of battle is a very seductive. We all know that it's horrible. We all know that it's awful. Everybody says so. But what is often denied is the attractiveness of it. And one of the elements of the attractiveness of it, and it speaks to some points that Sebastian has made in his book, is that you feel and you are absolutely, utterly necessary in that environment, not in some great cause or anything like that, but absolutely necessary to your immediate buddies, your comrades, and you are necessary for accomplishing the mission. And when that's all over with, it can be a very kind of depressing experience that suddenly you don't have this mission, suddenly you don't feel that you're all that necessary anymore, and you begin to look for and seek out situations in which you do feel and which you may be indeed necessary.
So you become a sort of adrenaline junkie, and I mean, both of your lifestyles would suggest that has happened to both of you in terms of what you did after what you did after Vietnam, and Sebastian, what you continue to do in from Sarajevo to Afghanistan and beyond.
Right. I would say that it was more, I mean, we all have a positive reaction to adrenaline, right? I mean, everyone does. I would say we were, to follow on what Phil's saying, we're meaning junkies. We want to do something that feels meaningful and that has consequences, even if those consequences are life and death, but still they're consequences. I grew up in a very, very placid, uninteresting suburb. And, frankly, it was a kind of slow death, spiritual death. And I mean, as a young man, I realized when I was 17 or 18, there was actually no way in Belmont, Massachusetts, that I was going to be able to demonstrate my sort of worthiness as a man, like as an adult, as a mature person. And nothing, I was never going to be tested in any way that meant anything, and without breaking the law. That was the only way so I went ahead and broke the law. Like, I mean, in a sort of minor inconsequential way, but I wanted to see, like, okay, can I get away with this? Can I outrun the police, actually, is something what I wanted to find out. I wish there'd been a way to demonstrate my sort of prowess in a way that served the tribe, but there just wasn't one. One way to do that is to enlist during wartime. I mean, that's a very classic way for young men to sort of prove themselves.
And is that why you joined the Marine Corps, or what drove you to that decision?
Yeah, I mean, I think I also grew up in a placid, inconsequential suburb. In
guys don't know anything about my neighborhood in Philadelphia, I'll tell you that.
It was in Illinois, not in Massachusetts, but I think a lot of them have a certain similarity. And I grew up in the shadow of World War II, and fathers and uncles and other relatives who had served in it in this great crusade, this great cause in which they were warriors, even if two of them I know never actually saw combat, but nevertheless I thought of them that way. And so I wanted to fulfill a destiny myself in that way, and that's why I joined the Marines. I want to add, though, that after I came back from Vietnam, after a period of searching and so forth, that one of the reasons I went into journalism and ended up doing the kind of journalism I did, which at first was investigative journalism and then later was foreign correspondence, was because I felt that that gave my life a certain amount of meaning, and that what I was doing was contributing in a positive way to, call it, my tribe or to my society. And one of my first early assignments was covering the mob in Chicago, and I felt that
Mayor Daley you're talking about, but
no, that was a different mob. That was the Irish mob. This was the and I felt that I was doing something that meant something, and that was my, if you want to call it that, my substitute for that feeling or that emotion that you have in combat.
Oh, that's a pretty tricky thing. And Sebastian, the soldiers that you interviewed in, and I have to say, if you have not watched the movie Coringall or Restrepo, Sebastian and Tim Hetherington, the late Tim Hetherington, who was killed, was a photographer with Sebastian. When I tell people about those two movies, I say, well, Restrepo was the front lines, and these two guys were in front of the front lines. They were, I mean, it was totally crazy what you were doing. you found that the people there were serving this higher cause, but they weren't talking about democracy or serving freedom. Why were they there, and what attracted them to come back there?
Well, there's two levels to it. I mean, they first of all, why did they join? Why did they join the military, and why did they work so hard to get into a combat unit? Like, if you just need a job and a skill and a paycheck, it's very easy to join the military and wind up, you know, changing the oil on Humvees at a rear base. There's nothing simpler than that. It's quite hard to get into a combat unit, the 173rd Airborne. I mean, it's like making the football team in high school. They all really wanted, every guy that I knew out there really wanted to experience combat. Like, actively, like, I want to know what happens in combat. A lot of them had fathers who fought in Vietnam, grandfathers in World War II. Most of them were sort of like middle-class white kids, lower middle-class white kids. And so they joined for that sort of personal reason. There was a sort of veneer of 9/11, you know, but that didn't really matter. You know, I think most of them would have not joined had there not been a war to fight, honestly. I think they would have done something else. But the proximal reason that they fought when they were in combat, I mean, the thing that got them to take risks, to go beyond themselves, to not think about themselves, actually, that loss of identity, that loss of sort of personal concern that is absolutely essential in combat, the thing that caused that was their love for each other. And I do mean love. I mean, if you are willing to risk your life or give your life for another person, you love that person, even if you don't like them very much. And the contract, if you're in a platoon in combat, the contract between everybody is that I may not like you, but I'll die for you. And if everyone acts that way, everyone in the platoon has a much higher chance of coming home alive. So that being embedded in, I mean, I don't mean in the journalistic sense, being part of a group like that, that has that kind of elemental commitment to itself, to each other, is incredibly reassuring. And war abounds in ironies, right? And one of them is that these guys literally felt safer in that sort of secure nest of the platoon. They felt safer in combat with each other than they felt alone in society not getting shot at. That is the cripplingly hard thing to navigate when soldiers come back. And what they missed when they got home, a little bit, I missed a little bit of the adrenaline, a little bit of the meaning, whatever, but I think what they really missed was being part of something, of serving something that was bigger than them that made them feel secure. And they could not get that in the cul-de-sac in their suburb where they lived.
Well, this band of brothers,
excuse
go ahead.
Me, I think the great Midwestern novelist Willa Cather said it perfectly, and I think it was in her novel My Antonia, where she says that the greatest happiness is to immerse oneself in something greater than oneself, and that I think is.
Now, this gets pretty tricky, though, when you look at Vietnam, where the word Vietnam became almost like a curse word and something you didn't tell people when you came back, that it had this smear on it, as you mentioned it in one of your readings earlier. It was, you know, fortunately now we have a Vietnam memorial, but I find watching now, years later, Ken Burns and saying, why is it now, 50 years later, we're still struggling with this? What is the connection between our society today and that society that produced Vietnam? What do you see as the link here?
Well, I think the interesting thing, more than interesting, is that 50 years down the line, this is still a subject that we talk about, that we discuss, and that people like Ken Burns make documentaries about. He spent 10 years on that, making that documentary. And I think the reason is that a lot of people in this country, and maybe most of the country, realizes subconsciously, if not consciously, that the country we're living in today was birthed, was formed during the Vietnam era. Not just the war itself, but the whole anti-war movement, the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, all of these things occurred simultaneously, but with the war as the epicenter of this, call it a kind of an earthquake, and or a social earthquake, a cultural earthquake. And that it is something we have not yet come to terms with, if I can find it. There is a quote that I like to cite. It's from a scholar named John Hellman from Ohio State University. He wrote a book some years ago called American Myth and the Legacy of Vietnam. And he said, quote, Vietnam is an experience that has severely called into question American myth. Americans entered Vietnam with certain expectations that a story, a distinctly American story, would unfold. When the story of America in Vietnam turned into something unexpected, the true nature of the larger American story itself became the subject of intense cultural dispute. On the deepest level, the legacy of Vietnam is the disruption of our story, of our explanation of the past and our vision of the future. And I think that that is something that we are still wrestling with. And I believe that Jack and I were discussing this earlier, that, I was discussing it with Doug, actually, that we knew that Ken Burns hoped that his documentary would, I think Doug's word would be crop dust America, and that everyone would be reopening that conversation about that war, but that hasn't happened because I think the country is just still finds that experience, despite its distance in time, still too difficult and too complex and too painful to deal with.
You're listening to the National Writers Series from IPR News Radio. Coming up, Sebastian Younger and Philip Caputo talk more about why soldiers struggle after returning home.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the historic City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Let's return to Jack Siegel's conversation with Sebastian Younger and Philip Caputo.
When you think about Vietnam and the lost, let's say, the hopelessness of the cause, the watching of the American embassy being evacuated in the last days again, and it immediately brought to my mind, okay, Quezon, Fallujah, Garmser, all these names of places that people never go to and never will, that were places where American soldiers went and fought and died. And we ask ourselves, what for? What are we doing this for? Now, Sebastian, you've dealt with people who've come back from the war quite a bit. What did they tell you? Why did they go to war? And what did they find when they get back here that caused them to sink into depression and alcoholism and drugs and so on?
So the soldiers that I was with didn't think about or talk about the rationale for the war, particularly in Afghanistan. It was quite obvious. It was 9/11. The people that perpetrated that horror had refuge in Afghanistan. President Bush demanded that they be rendered for justice to this country. The Taliban refused, and in we went. It had a kind of simple logic. Iraq did not. I refused to cover Iraq because I was completely opposed to it. And as a journalist, I felt that if I couldn't be neutral, if I couldn't be at least open to the logic of Iraq, then my reporting would be too biased. So I didn't go to Iraq. I don't know about that. But in Afghanistan, it made a kind of sense. There was year after year of terrible blunders. But again, the reason for the war was quite obvious, and so the soldiers didn't really talk about it. And also, they were young. I mean, they were 18, 19, 20 years old. When I was that age, I wasn't talking about sort of national, international affairs either. I mean, they were very interested in their own personal lives and in combat. Combat sort of out of the context of the political reason for it. So, but when they came home, the reason that they struggled psychologically wasn't because the war didn't have meaning. It didn't need to have meaning for them to go in the first place. That wasn't what they were predicating their effort on. They struggled for this, some of them were traumatized. About 10% of the U.S. military is in combat. The rest are mostly in support units, and they're really not traumatized, or certainly not regularly. But everyone apparently is prone to psychological troubles or vulnerable to them when they come back from that experience. And I think the reason is this sort of radical transition from a very close connected communal experience in a platoon back to modern society with these incredibly high rates of suicide and depression and everything else. Even the Peace Corps. Even Peace Corps volunteers that come back after 2 years overseas, usually in a small-scale, rural, agrarian community in the developing world, even Peace Corps volunteers, around 1 in 4, experience a really significant depression when they get back, quote, home, when they get home to this country. They struggle with depression, just like soldiers do. So if you think about our evolutionary past, we evolved to live in groups of 30, 40, 50 people in a very challenging environment where we really had to rely on one another. That's a platoon in combat. That's exactly what that is. We're wired for it. When we're exposed to it, we respond in very positive ways. And then when that's taken away from us, when you're repatriated back to the United States, for all of its convenience and its blessings and its luxury and its rule of law and everything else, for all of that, that primal experience of being in a small group, sleeping in a group, eating, taking meals in a group, doing things in a group, that resonates very, very deeply with people, and it's extremely traumatic to give it up.
Well, I have to ask, though, the experience of combat strips away part of your humanity and part of your social mores, I would say, that when, Phil, you described heading out on patrol, it was like sliding over the edge. You said to a sergeant, "We are so far out, it might as well be the dark side of the moon." And he replied, "What do you mean, might as well be?" You feel like you're marooned on a hostile shore. You're out somewhere that's not of this earth. You are in another world where the rules are completely stripped away. You can shoot someone who's a certain distance away and it's legal. But if they get close to you and put their hands up, you're not supposed to shoot at some point. There's these rules of engagement, so-called. When you go through that process over and over again, or you're out at the Restrepo and you've got a 50 caliber machine gun in front of you, and you see, well, I wonder how far this thing can shoot and what it could do to a guy a mile away, and you do it, and that's legal. There has to be an impact on the individual first and then on society. What is that? Are we paying a price that we're just going to keep paying now?
Well, a theme that I've touched on over and over again in the fiction I've written has been how people react and how they behave in situations where the usual guideposts to what we would call moral behavior are absent. And certainly in combat, so to speak, you have a license to kill, the ultimate taboo. And this tends to affect the perpetrators or the people who actually do the killing, but usually after you've returned to society. You look, even now, I mean, I look back on myself half a century ago, and I'm like looking back on somebody that I don't quite recognize. And I think that one of the paradoxes of this experience, as Sebastian says, there is this intense camaraderie that you have living with this so-called tribal group. At the same time, your situation is miserable. You know what I used to think of when I was there? I said, wouldn't it be great to wake up in the morning with on clean sheets with a cup of coffee? That was my big dream of returning home, was to drink a cup of coffee on a bed with clean sheets. But once you get back to the clean sheets and the cup of coffee, all of a sudden something vital seems to be missing. And also I would have to add is that sometimes your conscience does begin to prick you about some of the things that you did when you were there. Some of them would be justified by any rules of war, if indeed war has any rules. And others, not so much.
Yeah, Cora Morlanta says, I killed him, the first person he killed, but he wasn't the only casualty. The civilized version of me died with him.
Yeah. Hmm. And that's...
Yeah. But, you know, keep in mind, this isn't the result of a kind of military training, right? I mean, that military training exploits something that already is a... human capacity. Many of you, I think, would easily resort to violence if your children were threatened, if your spouse was threatened. You may or may not if you yourself were threatened. But certainly, people who are defenseless and counting on you for protection, if they were threatened by someone who meant to really harm them, I think most people wouldn't hesitate. And it would leave you with a psychological legacy. But in that moment, I mean, we are the descendants of earlier humans that acted with violence when confronted with violence rather than die. And I can say for myself, I mean, I grew up during Vietnam, a very liberal household, a pacifist in every for 100 miles in every direction, the works, right? And my film, The Last Patrol, I took two combat vets from Restrepo and another a war reporter. We walked from Washington, D.C. up to Philly along the railroad line, sleeping under bridges and abandoned buildings in the woods, cooking our meals over fires, all the way to Pittsburgh. And somewhere in Pennsylvania, we were camped out under an old bridge, and someone started shooting at us. And all of us had been in combat. All of us had lost people in combat. None of us were going back to combat. And suddenly there was that familiar snapping sound of bullets going over your head. And I really flipped out. These were my guys, right? Like, I was the oldest in this group. The trip was my idea. All we had with us was a machete. And I grabbed the machete, and I'm a good runner. And I thought, I'm gonna get behind this guy. We're in the woods. I thought, I'm going to just do a big circle. I'm going to come up behind this guy. And he stopped shooting, and he left before I got him. But thank God, because I don't know what I would have done. I wasn't upset that I was in danger. I was upset that he was endangering people that I cared about, that I loved, and who were counting on me, right? And so that capacity, frankly, it's in all of us, I think.
Now, that contrasts so remarkably with the story you began your book with about traveling across country, and you see a man heading towards you. And could you relate that story again?
Yeah, I mean, there's sort of the twin faces of humanity is that we're capable of organized violence against outsiders, but also that we really take care of our own. I mean, even chimpanzees, you know, their closest animal relatives, really do not take care in the same way of the vulnerable and the weak in their own society in the way that we do. And so I was hitchhiking across the country when I was young, and I wound up in outside Gillette, Wyoming, which you know, was very cold. It was late fall. It was a tough town. I think it probably still is. It's a coal mining town. And I was out there on the highway, and I, you know, stuck for an hour or two. People were throwing beer bottles at me, you know, pickup trucks, guys throwing beer bottles at me. A very hostile place. And eventually I saw this guy walking towards me in this sort of bitter cold. And he was clearly homeless. I mean, you know, you can tell from a distance. I mean, this guy clearly lived outside and was not doing well. And I had a backpack. I'd saved up some money, and I had, you know, food in it. I was doing this adventure, right? And this guy came walking up to me at a lunchbox. And I just thought, this guy's got nothing. I got a backpack full of stuff. He's gonna rob me. I mean, I felt really threatened. And he's a big guy. And he walked up to me, and he said, where are you going? And I said, I'm going to California. And he said, how much food do you got? And in my sort of paranoid, young, youthful, paranoid way, I thought, he wants me to open my pack up, and then he's going to see what I have, and it's not going to go well. So I said, I just have a little cheese. And he looked at me, he said, you know, you can't get to California on a little cheese. He said I broken down car in town. Every day I walk out to the coal mines, 3 miles. Once or twice a week, someone's sick and they need me. The other days they don't need me, and I walk back to my car. And today they don't need me, so I won't be needing this. And he lifted up his lunchbox. He said, "You need it more than I do." And he opened it up, and it was a bologna sandwich and an apple and a bag of potato chips that I think he'd probably gotten at a church that morning. And of course I protested, and he insisted, and he gave me the lunch, and he gave me a sort of lifelong lesson about taking responsibility for others. He'd seen me out on the highway, and he figured I was homeless like he was, right? And he just went out there to check on a brother, basically.
That's a beautiful story. Yeah. Now, we want to give the audience a chance to join with us, and maybe I'll ask Phil if there's something that we haven't touched on already that you might want to go back to. I was reading over my notes, and Carl Marlantis talked about how we measure our success in war. He says one thing that was very important in Vietnam was the kill ratio. And what was the kill ratio? It was the number of Vietnamese that we killed versus the number of Americans that they killed. And he said this number we killed of them versus the number they killed of us, it didn't matter. Only the us part mattered to us. And that we leave a trail behind when in Afghanistan, in Vietnam, in Iraq, and now in Syria, no doubt, and Yemen and 15 other places. This trail of us and them that we've left behind. Too heavy.
I'm sorry.
It's not really a question. I think it's a statement an observation we all kind of agree with.
Yeah, you're right.
And but what you're talking about is the emotional, the sort of emotional gap between people who fight the war and people who run it. And my book is about small scale societies. And in a small scale society, all the things that keep people alive, which includes warfare, by the way, all the things that keep people alive and safe, are at least the whole community is at least intimately acquainted with those processes, if not actually involved in them. So if the Apache go out on a raid against their sort of Navajo enemies and kill some people or get killed, those deaths are experienced by the entire community. I mean, the warriors are doing the killing, but the entire community, morally speaking, is part of the killing. When Custer attacked the villages on the Little Bighorn in 1876, after the battle was over, it was the women that went up the hill and killed the wounded. They were part of it, right? And the problem with a large-scale modern society is that these processes are sort of subcontracted out. And it's not just soldiering. It's everything, right? I'm an environmentalist. I mean, just on some basic level, there are these ironies that no one wants to deal with. Like, I'm an environmentalist. I think that carbon emissions are killing the planet. I drive a car. You know what I mean? I mean, how can I do that? We all do that, right? I mean, I have friends, very liberal friends, during the Iraq War, read bumper stickers that said, no blood for oil, on their car. Right? So there's this distance between your beliefs and the things that are actually keeping you alive. And in a small-scale society, all those things are integrated. And they're integrated morally as well. And I think the problem with war in a modern society is that morality is not integrated. And it's extremely painful for the soldiers. And I think in a sort of unconscious way, it's painful for the civilian population as well.
Well, that we were maybe in that draft age period, and people were drafted into the military, not so much in the Marine Corps. I guess you guys were the elite. You just ask any Marine, and they'll tell you. Yeah. But this if society is the group in place of the tribe, the big society, then all of us should be contributing. And I think your father once gave you a lecture about that, Sebastian. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, just very briefly, my father grew up in Europe. He came to this his father was Jewish. He came to this country during World War II. He was a two-time war refugee from the Spanish Civil War and then from World War II. He came here. He had asthma, so he couldn't join the military. He became a physicist, and he helped this nation quite a lot in that capacity. He was a pacifist, and he also made it very clear to me that this country saved Europe from fascism, saved humanity, basically, from fascism. And but I grew up during Vietnam. Every adult I knew was against it. And so when I got my Selective Service card in the mail in 1980, I was 18, I think I was the first birth year to get the Selective Service card when the draft ended. I can't remember. Anyway, I was one of the first. And I didn't know what this was. Like, what the hell is this? I thought the draft was over. And I went to my father. I said, I'm not signing this, right? Like, this is ridiculous. The government wants to know my address so they can come find me if they have another war to fight. Are you kidding? Right? And, I'd been nicely programmed by my environment, right? That's how I saw this. And he looked at me. And he was a deep, deep pacifist, right? He said, oh, no, you're signing that. And I said, really? And he said, there's thousands of graves of young American men your age in Europe, and they died defending the world from fascism. And you don't owe your country nothing, and you might owe your country your life. And the next war to be fought might have to be fought. And if you think it's not a moral war, then it's your duty to protest it, and even go to jail if you have to. But you don't know that yet. and it might be another World War II, and your country really might need you. And when he put it that way, all of a sudden I realized, oh my God, I can be part of something bigger than myself, which is what every young person wants to feel, that feeling, right? And so I signed that card with an enormous amount of pride. And sent it in, and it was the first time that I felt like I was a citizen of a country, because something was being asked of me. And I think it's a real tragedy in this. I think it's not moral to send people to fight a war they don't believe in, but I think it's completely moral to ask people to contribute their time and energy to the nation they live in. Yeah.
I think that's a good moment to ask that the house lights come up a little bit, and we'll give you an opportunity to ask a question. That's a question is something that ends with a question mark. So I know we all have strong feelings about this and that, but we also have a lot of wonderful, fabulous full house here, and so I want to give people the opportunity to ask questions, and we'll start here in the back.
Hello, and thank you for being here tonight. I'm wondering if any of you have given any thought to a possible connection, whether it be psychologically, evolutionarily, even tribally, to the kind of war experiences that you've written about and the epidemic, the prevalence of gun violence in our country.
Anyone armed here?
No. I think that the gun violence in fact, by the way, I just read in the local paper here that there was another mass shooting in California today. Not quite the casualty toll as the previous two, but there were four people killed at random by a gunman. But I think the problem there, culturally, I'm not going to speak about gun control or the number of guns, but culturally is that this kind of rugged individualism, when it becomes pathological, turns into this extreme isolation of these shooters, these people who they have no connection whatever to their fellow human being and are so, if you will, self-involved, so self-aggrandizing that they feel that if they have a grudge against society, if they've lost their job, they've had an argument with their wife, whatever the cause may be, they have some kind of right to express their unhappiness, their misery, by eliminating other people's lives. And that to me is the connection is that they're in a way not tribal. They're utterly, utterly isolated human beings with no sense of community, no sense of connection with their fellow human being.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I'll just add to it. I mean, there are countries with a higher crime rate. There are other countries with very easy access to guns like we have. Every country has deranged people in it. But we are the only country that perpetrates this bizarre sort of nihilistic thing of mass shootings. Gang violence, there's a kind of logic to gang violence, right? They're turf wars, basically. There's a kind of logic to crime. There's a kind of logic to all of it, although they're tragedies as well, but they make a kind of sense. Mass shootings of people you don't know, that's completely nihilistic, right? There's no logical end point to that. And we are the only country that does that to ourselves regularly. And I'll add that the communities that these kinds of mass shootings happen in, almost without exception, are majority white, safe, middle class, Christian, low crime communities. A mass shooting of this sort has never happened in a low income, quote, ghetto neighborhood in an inner city. It just isn't. There's other kinds of crime. There's other kinds of violence. But that particular kind of nihilism, where you bring an assault weapon into a school and see how many people you can kill before you get killed, that kind of thing has never happened in a low-income urban neighborhood. And I can't prove this, right? I'm not even trying to prove this, but to me, it's, I think, probably not a coincidence that the very communities that seem to breed depression and loneliness and suicide and isolation also offer so little community that people who have a real emotional problem don't feel compelled to protect others from their violence. They let it out. And for all of the stresses of poor urban communities, there is some community there that may buffer mentally ill people from doing that. I don't know, but it's remarkable. Those statistics are remarkable.
In the back on the right, yeah.
I have an appreciation and a request that I can make it into a question. The appreciation is that Sebastian, for about 18 months, reigning Liberty Ranch, and I probably can speak for Peace Ranch too, have been using your book as a blueprint for understanding, for planning, for programs, and you're impacting lives, you're saving lives.
Thank you. My
request, it goes back to something we talked about 2 hours ago out in the lobby, and it still puzzles me, is why do UK military who fight in the same zone come back and only have 50% of the PTSD and depression as the American soldiers? What is different?
Thank you. I can answer this pretty quickly, I think. The Israeli military has a PTSD rate of 1%. The reason is, Israeli psychologists will tell you, is because of national service. Everyone serves in the military, and that buffers people against psychological harm. The U.S. military has a PTSD rate of 20%, which is amazing considering that only 10% of the U.S. military is actually in combat. So something grave is going on when they come home. The British military has a rate of about half of what we do. There is no explanation. They have the same kind of modern society that we do. It's a smaller nation. Maybe that helps. I don't know. But the one explanation I actually did read, and it was just a theory by an English psychologist, and he literally said, England is a drinking culture, and they may be medicating themselves and basically camouflaging their PTSD.
And voting for Brexit. Right.
Well, all right, this was a perfect segue, because the bar has remained open specifically tonight. The two wonderful authors will be outside signing books for you.
Thank you all.
Thank you all for being here.
That was Sebastian Younger and Philip Caputo talking with Jack Siegel. Sebastian Younger's latest book is Tribe, on Homecoming and Belonging. Philip Caputo's is A Rumor of War. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org. And listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.